Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
This episode is supported by FX's Clipped, the scandalous story of the 2014 Clippers owner's racist remarks captured on tape and heard around the world. The series charts the tape's impact on a dysfunctional basketball organization striving to win against their reputation as the most cursed team in the league. Starring Lawrence Fishburne, Jackie Weaver, Cleopatra Coleman, and Ed O'Neill. FX's Clipped, streaming June 4th, only on Hulu.
Welcome to Washington Today on C-SPAN Radio for Monday, November 6, 2023. Donald Trump, former president and 2024 Republican presidential candidate, testifies in the civil fraud trial against him, his family, and his company, clashing often with the judge, who repeatedly tells him to answer the lawyer's questions put to him and not give campaign-style speeches. President Joe Biden visits an Amtrak train maintenance facility in Delaware to announce $16 billion for two dozen projects on Amtrak's Northeast Corridor, money from the 2021 infrastructure law. Some House Republicans object to their leadership, including cuts to Amtrak funding in a spending bill for the Transportation Department. Senate back in session to consider aid to Israel, with majority Democrats rejecting the House Republican passed version that also includes offsetting cuts to the IRS budget. The Biden administration again urging Israel to pause the assault on Hamas in Gaza to allow for humanitarian aid in and hostages out, as the Gaza Health Ministry says the number of people killed in Gaza is now over 10,000. And U.S. Veterans Affairs Secretary Dennis McDonough, ahead of Veterans Day, says the VA processed over 2 million claims for benefits last year. Story from the Washington Post, former President Donald Trump had a contentious day on the witness stand Monday in the civil trial accusing him and his company of committing rampant fraud. He drew multiple warnings from the trial judge for veering off topic and criticizing the proceedings, while also staunchly defending the way he and the Trump Organization valued their properties. The case involves a $250 million lawsuit filed by New York Attorney General Letitia James, a Democrat, who says Donald Trump and others intentionally inflated the value of his assets to secure better financial terms. Donald Trump denies wrongdoing. That from the Washington Post summarizing the day. And after Donald Trump spoke for multiple hours, he came outside the courtroom to speak with reporters for a few minutes.
How'd it go today?
How'd it go?
I think it went very well. I think you were there. You listened. You see what a scam this is. This is a case that should have never been brought. It's a case that should be dismissed immediately. The fraud was on behalf of the court. The court was the fraudster in this case. They made references to assets that were very valuable, and they said they had no idea what the numbers were when they said $18 million for Mar-a-Lago, and it's 50 to 100 times that amount by any estimation. It's a terrible thing that's happened here. We're taking days and days and weeks, and it goes on, and then you look at the outside world and what's happened, but of course they're getting their wish because I don't have to be here for the most part, but I sort of do have to be here because I want to be here because it's a scam. And this is a case that should have never been brought, and it's a case that now should be dismissed. Everybody saw what happened today. Everybody saw what happened with their star witness who admitted that. I never told him what he originally said. I did. He admitted that he lied, and he has absolutely no credibility whatsoever. That's their only witness. That's your only witness. And I think you saw what I had to say today, and it was very conclusive. Everything we did was absolutely right. To think that we're being sued and spending all this time and money, and yet people being killed all over the world, that this country could stop. With inflation and all of the other problems that this country has, I think it's a disgrace. And when you look at the numbers, the poll numbers that came out today from the New York Times and CBS, I'm sure the Times was not too happy. But people are sick and tired of what's happening. This is a sad, I think it's a very sad day for America. But anyway, this is a case that should have never been brought, and it's a case that should be immediately dismissed.
Donald Trump outside the courtroom in New York City after his testimony in the civil fraud case. There were no cameras in the courtroom for that testimony, only at the beginning of the proceedings when you could just see him at the defense table before he went up and took the stand. But print reporters were in there and taking notes. CNN summarizes it this way. Donald Trump brought bombastic rhetoric to the witness stand Monday in the civil fraud case against him and his business as he spent his time on the stand attacking the New York Attorney General who brought the case and the judge overseeing the trial itself. Trump's testimony at times mimicked his appearance on the campaign trail, where the former president has made the four criminal cases against him, along with the New York Attorney General civil fraud case, a central part of his argument to be elected president again in 2024. Judge Arthur Engoron, who has clashed with Trump throughout the trial, at first tried to stop the former president's political barbs and speechifying, telling his lawyer, Chris Keyes, to control your client and threatening to have Trump removed as a witness. Eventually, the judge stopped trying to control Trump. He and the Attorney General's lawyer questioning Trump let him rant, and then mostly disregarded the missives. That was the summary from CNN. Case brought by the New York Attorney General, Letitia James, who made her own statement outside the courthouse today.
Today we heard from Donald Trump in our case against him, other defendants, and the Trump Organization. He rambled, he hurled insults, but we expected that. At the end of the day, the documentary evidence demonstrated that, in fact, he falsely inflated his assets to basically enrich himself and his family. He continued to persistently engage in fraud. The numbers don't lie. And Mr. Trump obviously can engage in all of these distractions. And that what he committed on the stand today, engaging in distractions and engaging in name-calling. But I will not be bullied. I will not be harassed. This case will go on. We look forward to hearing the testimony of Ivanka Trump on Wednesday, and then we plan on closing our case. And then there'll be some motions on Thursday, and then the defense will present their case in chief. Justice will prevail, and it's important that all of you understand that we have already been victorious in our motion for summary judgment. And now we look forward to disgorgement and to the remaining counts in our action against Donald Trump and his repeated and consistent fraud against the citizens of the great state of New York.
New York Attorney General Letitia James outside the courthouse in New York City, where Donald Trump testified today in the civil fraud trial. She spoke after the testimony was finished. Earlier in the day, during a break in the testimony, the Guardian newspaper reports it this way. Trump returned to assailing the judge almost as soon as he was out of the courtroom for the lunch break, angrily posting on Truth Social a graphic of the judge's early remark admonishing him for making irrelevant statements during his testimony. The post quoted New York Supreme Court Justice Arthur Engoron saying, "No, I'm not here to hear what Trump has to say," a line that came during a furious exchange between the judge and Trump's lawyer, Alina Haba. The exchange was remarkable for its tone and hostility. Engoron is clearly furious at Trump and his legal team, but reserved particular ire at Trump's lawyer, Haba, when she pushed back at him and said he was there to listen to Trump's responses. The judge turned to her, almost shouting, told her to sit down. Trump was shaking his head as his lawyers were dressed down, and said unprompted, "This is a very, very unfair trial, and I hope the public is watching." That was from The Guardian. Alina Haba came out then and spoke to reporters.
"I'm not here to hear what he has to say. That was what rang true, loud, and could not have been more honest, coming from the judge who has already predetermined that my client committed fraud before we even walked into this courtroom. I'm not here to hear what he has to say. Then why exactly am I being paid as an attorney, and why exactly are taxpayer dollars being used in this courtroom? The answer is very clear. Because Ms. James wants to stand right here like she did this morning and call my client a liar, call the company fraudulent, and make a name for herself. She said this morning that the numbers don't lie and they won't lie in this case. Well, Ms. James, I have a message for you. The numbers didn't lie when you ran for governor, and that's why you dropped out. And the numbers don't lie when President Trump runs for office in 2024. And those numbers are loud and clear. This country is falling apart. And if we don't stop corruption in courtrooms where attorneys are gagged, where attorneys are not allowed to say what they need to say to protect their clients' interests, it doesn't matter what your politics are. Everyone has a right in this country to get up and put a defense. I don't care who you are. You have a right to hire a lawyer who can put objections on the record. You have a right to hire a lawyer who can stand up and say something when they see something wrong. But I was told to sit down today. I was yelled at. And I've had a judge who is unhinged slamming a table. Let me be very clear. I don't tolerate that in my life. I'm not going to tolerate it here. And you know what? You shouldn't either.
Alina Haba, attorney for Donald Trump, speaking to reporters outside the courthouse in New York City during the lunch break in the civil fraud trial. Donald Trump is a 2024 Republican presidential candidate. So is Chris Christie, former New Jersey governor, who has made it a point of his campaign to criticize the policy and antics of Donald Trump. Chris Christie was on CNN today.
He knows that he's committed fraud. He knows that this is over, and this is just about playing to the grandstand, Dana. He knows that he's going to have very little impact upon the damages in this case, no matter what he says, because he knows that at core, he did exactly what they're accusing him of doing, which was to inflate his net worth in an attempt to be able to borrow more money and to get more favorable terms from the bankers and financiers that he was working with. And so this is not the least bit surprising to me. Donald Trump, under normal circumstances, can't answer a direct question. And a number of you on that panel right now have interviewed him, so you know that's the case. And that's when he's under very little stress. Imagine the stress he's under now, knowing he may never be able to do business again in the state where he was born and raised and built the company that his father left to him into the even bigger company that it became.
And, you know, you mentioned how sort of personal this is for him, and the fact that this has already been decided. He already has been found liable. And the question is, how much is he going to pay when it comes to damages? One of the things that I've been hearing from his political team is that they wanted to use today as kind of a political and legal Super Bowl to try to take the support that he has, and as one of his opponents, I know that you're painfully aware that he has a lot of support within the Republican electorate, and make it even more hardened. Do you think that is a real possibility in the upside-down world that we're living in?
I don't think so for this reason, Dana. They're not seeing it. They're hearing it being characterized by reporters in the courtroom. This would be much more of an effective strategy for Donald Trump if he were on camera. If he were on camera and there were cameras in that courtroom, I think that would be a much more effective strategy for him, given that he's going to lose on the legal case anyway, so he could do it. This really, I don't think, will translate much with people. I think this will be a lot of noise, and those who believe that he's being persecuted will continue to believe that, and those who don't. But this is why I've said all along that he will eventually show up on the debate stage, because he knows that his most effective moments are when he's on television, when he's on camera, looking into the camera and being able to make his case. What he doesn't want is he doesn't want me to be on the stage.
Republican presidential candidate Chris Christie today on CNN. Donald Trump's testimony today in the civil fraud trial in New York City follows testimony of his sons, Donald Trump Jr. and Eric Trump, last week, and his daughter Ivanka Trump scheduled to testify on Wednesday. This is Washington Today. From Associated Press, President Joe Biden, perhaps the nation's biggest Amtrak fan, headed to Delaware on Monday to tout new federal investments for trains on the heavily trafficked Northeast Corridor. The president visited Bear, Delaware, to announce more than $16 billion in new funding that will go toward 25 passenger rail projects between Boston and Washington, the White House says. Bear is located about 12 miles from Joe Biden's home in Wilmington. The president spoke at the Amtrak Bear maintenance shops.
Look, guys, we're announcing historic investment in America's railroads. I've been talking about this for a long time, I know, but finally, we're getting it done. More than $16 billion, 16 with a B, billion dollars here in the Northeast Corridor. 25 different projects, all to build the Northeast Corridor from Boston to Washington. It's part of my agenda to invest in America, and I've been fighting for this for a long time. To invest in Americans, not just America, there's no better place to make this announcement than in my home state of Delaware, here in Bear, the maintenance facility. And a few miles away to the Wilmington shops, over 800 people keep trains in the entire Northeast Corridor working in good order. And it's not been easy because some are pretty old trains. Machinists, electricians, pipe fitters, facility workers, you know, coach cleaners, boilermakers, laborers, foremen. But they have one thing in common. They're all good-paying union jobs. Union jobs. Union jobs. I've been saying a long time, the middle class built America, but unions built the middle class. Unions built the middle class. For years in the Senate, and as Vice President, I met with the workers in these shops and I made them a promise. I said I'd do all I could and all my power to fight to keep their jobs and to make our rail system better and to work on the Northeast Corridor. I told them I'd fight for them and with them, and they stuck with me. And that's just what I've done.
President Joe Biden at the Amtrak train repair shop in Bear, Delaware today. The White House says that Amtrak's Northeast Corridor is the busiest rail corridor in the United States with about 800,000 daily trips. Story from Roll Call reporting on the $16.4 billion for the 25 rail projects in the Northeast Corridor, the president announced, writing, the Transportation Department grants allocated from the 2021 infrastructure law come as U.S. House lawmakers had to delay votes on a fiscal year 2024 spending bill for the Transportation and Housing and Urban Development Departments over Amtrak funding. Some Republicans from states along the corridor, which runs from Washington to Boston, said they wouldn't support the measure because of steep cuts to rail funding. The House bill would slash 64%, or $1.6 billion, from Amtrak's fiscal 2023 level. The Senate's Transportation HUD appropriations bill passed last week as part of a three-bill spending minibus would provide $2.5 billion for Amtrak, far above the House's bill funding level of $876 million, that reporting from Roll Call. Well, the House is continuing to work through the 12 regular fiscal year 2024 spending bills, but Speaker Mike Johnson saying he does not expect they'll all pass and become law by the time temporary government funding expires November 17th, so another temporary spending bill will be needed. C-SPAN spoke this morning to Stephen Dennis, Bloomberg News congressional reporter, about the House Republican strategy on the spending bills and also the separate emergency spending request from President Biden for aid to Israel, Ukraine, Indo-Pacific, and the U.S.-Mexico border, and the House passage last week of a $14 billion Israel aid bill that also has $14 billion cut from the IRS.
These bills basically have no chance of becoming law as is. They're under veto threats from the administration. They spend far less than Democrats thought they were agreeing to with the previous speaker. And they have a lot of policy riders on them. So they're kind of messaging bills that he needs to keep at least his caucus together on, which is going to be very hard to do because he has 18 members in Biden districts that Joe Biden won, that are worried about their reelection. So they're voting for a lot of controversial policies that aren't going to become law. And members of Congress in tough districts don't like doing that. So this transportation bill, it's going to be on the floor, have a lot of amendment votes. There are big cuts to railroads and Amtrak. There are a lot of members who have Amtrak railroads going through their district, have constituents on those tracks. So the unions for the railroads are trying to kill the bill. It's going to be interesting to see if that bill ultimately passes. Then we have a financial services and general government bill that has a lot of cultural amendments teed up on everything from the IRS to climate change and all sorts of other policies, maybe some crypto amendments that could be interesting. And then we presumably, towards the end of this week, will have a bill to keep the government open. And that, you know, he has a few days to sort of talk to his members. One of the good things for a new leader is when you have these appropriations bills on the floor, members are on the floor. You can go talk to them. You can have your whip team talk to them. You have lots of time to sort of try to massage the differences and try to make people happy with what you ultimately end up doing. So it's going to be interesting to see how Johnson sort of tries to do basically the same strategy that Kevin McCarthy did. Kevin McCarthy kept the government open with a clean CR. And he, on the other issue that divides the Republicans, Ukraine funding, the new speaker is trying to pair it with a border security combo package, which he has said is next. And that is a very tough road to hoe because there are a lot of Republicans who don't want to fund Ukraine, period. So he's going to need Democratic votes. Democrats aren't going to vote for the H.R. 2, which is the House GOP immigration package. And there are negotiations that have been going on the last several days, particularly in the Senate, bipartisan negotiations to try to thread this needle to have a Ukraine border package that can pass both chambers and reach the president's desk.
We saw the House pass the Israel aid bill. Aside from the bill itself, what does it say about how Johnson plans to do things? Does that give examples, so to speak, or at least reveals a little bit about it, how he plans to go about strategy-wise?
Yeah, I mean, I think what he did is he went for the low-hanging fruit on his first big bill. The low-hanging fruit is there is broad support in his conference for aiding Israel, and there's broad support for defunding the IRS. They all agree on those two things, so you put them in a bill. The tougher bills are when you include items that people don't like. You know, and he has such a small majority, if five people stand up and say, I will never vote for Ukraine, then he has to go negotiate with Democrats. And that was, you know, something we saw with McCarthy. One of the reasons why these appropriations bills did not come to the floor before September 30th is because groups of conservatives were insisting on various riders and then saying they wouldn't vote for the bill anyways. That still wasn't good enough for them. And so McCarthy was like, look, I wanted to do these bills before the August recess, and I couldn't bring them to the floor because conservatives were blocking me. So, you know, it's a very difficult balance here when you are a speaker with a four-vote majority and the Democrats are not going to vote for these things. And we're seeing that again and again. Every day is going to be a test. Every amendment on the floor is a test. Right now, he's got, you know, these transportation and financial services bills and the amendments on them are sort of, you know, they're almost practice. You know, we have like sort of the next 2 weeks are the big Super Bowl of, are we going to shut down the government or not? What are we going to shut it down over? Are we going to fund Ukraine or not? And these are sort of practice runs of just, can he keep his conference together? Does he still have that honeymoon? Can he do things that some of them don't like? And then they say, you know, I didn't like this bill. I'll vote against it, but I'm not going to try to topple you right out of the gate. And, you know, I think that that's an open question. His own conference, they're fighting each other on X, Marjorie Taylor Greene going after Chip Roy and Lauren Boebert, and every day it seems like another faction is going after another faction, and certainly Ukraine is something where the conference is split down the middle. It's a very tough issue for Johnson to figure out, but he has said we can't allow Putin to win. So that is, he had previously voted against Ukraine. Bunch of the defense hawks on both the House and the Senate have been arguing to him and seem to have convinced him that Ukraine does need aid. But his counter is we need to take care of the U.S. border first. That is the big sort of negotiation that's happening right now, particularly in the Senate. People like Senator Chris Murphy, Kyrsten Sinema have been working with Senator Lankford and some of the other Republicans to try to find some way to affect the migrant flows, to reduce the numbers that are coming over the border. And that's not really about money. That's more about policy issues. Typically, Democrats don't want to change the asylum policies, but they do have incentives now, political incentives. Joe Biden's poll numbers are not so hot. And going into an election year, they also have other issues, given that their other priorities are being held hostage right now, particularly aid to Ukraine.
Stephen Dennis, Bloomberg News congressional reporter, joining C-SPAN on the Washington Journal program this morning. And The Hill News. com reporting today that Senate Republicans led by Lindsey Graham of South Carolina, Tom Cotton of Arkansas, and James Lankford of Oklahoma on Monday unveiled a list of immigration reforms they will demand be attached to any foreign aid package funding the war in Ukraine, signaling a difficult negotiation with Democrats in the next few weeks. They want the Department of Homeland Security to resume construction of the southwestern border wall, beef up pay for Border Patrol agents, reform the nation's asylum laws, crack down on humanitarian parole of illegal immigrants, and deny asylum to migrants who cross through safe third countries before coming to the United States. That from The Hill. The Senate Majority Whip, Dick Durbin, Democrat from Illinois, spoke today on the Senate floor about the Israel aid bill that passed the House last week, $14 billion, offset by an equal amount from the IRS budget, and what he would like would be the president's request for aid to Ukraine.
At the Appropriations Committee hearing last week, Secretaries Blinken and Austin underscored the necessity of this funding request. They made clear that it is critical to deliver urgent national security priorities as laid out in the president's rhetoric. These challenges facing the world are interrelated, so it's important that we deliver aid in one unified package that speaks to America's values abroad. I asked Secretaries Blinken and Austin about the recent visit by the terrorist organization Hamas leadership to, believe it or not, Putin in Moscow. Secretary Blinken was blunt. Putin is allied with any effort that may distract the United States from the war in Ukraine, or that undermines democracy and the rule of law. The Secretary added that other malign actors are watching closely to assess America's reaction and resolve. That is why one comprehensive supplemental that can address all of these interconnected global needs is the only way forward. When asked about the United States' role in the world, President Biden explained that we have not only a financial responsibility, but the moral responsibility to support democracies worldwide. I agree. Right now, the global community faces profound challenges, the outcomes of which will reverberate to every corner of the world for decades to come. As a global superpower, America has a central role to play in defending freedom. It is not only the right thing to do, it's a smart thing to do. Last week, the House passed a Republican-led plan to provide billions of dollars only to Israel, tragically ignoring this call for leadership. Madam President, I just challenge everyone to take a look at how the Republicans put together this package, even this package to aid Israel. The House bill would cynically cut funding from the Internal Revenue Service that is being used to have auditors catch wealthy tax cheaters in America. The House Speaker wants to cut that. You and I represent thousands of Illinoisans, good families who know their tax obligations. They're not happy about them, but they face them and deal with them honestly. Only a handful of people are misusing their power and their money to avoid tax responsibility. We need to stop that. They need to pay their fair share of taxes, particularly the wealthy among us. So how does the House Republican leadership pay for aid to Israel? Eliminates auditors in the Internal Revenue Service who are trying to catch these tax cheats. What are they thinking?
The Senate Majority Whip Dick Durbin, Democrat from Illinois, today on the Senate floor. Over in the House, two Republicans have introduced privileged resolutions to censure Congresswoman Rashida Tlaib, Democrat from Michigan, over her latest remarks about the war between Israel and Hamas. The two House Republicans are Marjorie Taylor Greene and Rick McCormick, both from Georgia. Congressman McCormick cites Congresswoman Tlaib for, quote, promoting false narratives regarding the October 7th Hamas attack on Israel and calling for the destruction of the state of Israel. He also, as he presented his resolution on the floor today, referenced a video that Congresswoman Tlaib posted over the weekend.
Whereas on November 3, 2023, Representative Tlaib published on social media a video containing the phrase, quote, from the river to the sea, end quote, which is widely recognized as a genocidal call to violence to destroy the state of Israel and its people to replace it with a Palestinian state extending from the Jordan River to the Mediterranean Sea. Whereas Representative Tlaib doubled down on this call to violence by falsely describing the from the river to the sea as an aspirational call for freedom, human rights, and peaceful coexistence, despite it clearly entailing Israel's destruction and the denial of its fundamental right to exist. And whereas Representative Tlaib has repeatedly displayed conduct entirely unbecoming of a member of the House of Representatives by calling for the destruction of the State of Israel and dangerously promoting false narratives regarding a brutal, large-scale terrorist attack against civilian targets inside the sovereign territory of a major non-NATO ally, while hundreds of Israeli and American hostages remain in terrorist captivity. Now, therefore, be it resolved that Representative Rashida Tlaib be censured.
Congressman Rick McCormick, Republican from Georgia, today on the House floor. Under the rules of the House, his privileged resolution and the one introduced today by Congresswoman Marjorie Taylor Greene, also Republican from Georgia, accusing Rashida Tlaib of, quote, anti-Semitic activity and sympathizing with terrorist organizations. Those two resolutions must be taken up by the House within 2 legislative days, so votes could happen regarding them by Wednesday. Here is the video that Congresswoman Tlaib posted. You're going to hear from her, also clips of President Joe Biden and John Kirby, a spokesperson with the White House National Security Council, and Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. And she also included footage, and you can hear the sounds of the protests in cities across the United States. And there's also footage of wounded children in Gaza.
We stand with Israel.
President, the American people are not with you on this one.
Innocent civilians are going to be hurt going forward. I wish I could tell you something different. I wish that that wasn't going to happen, but it is going to happen.
I want to thank President Biden for his unequivocal support.
Remember in 2024.
Congresswoman Rashida Tlaib, Democrat from Michigan, in her video posted over the weekend, it included street protests across the United States and the chanting that you heard. And a graphic on the end of the video accuses President Biden of supporting genocide against Palestinians. A story from Reuters, U.S. President Joe Biden and Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu discussed the potential for tactical pauses in strikes on Gaza during talks on Monday, according to a spokesperson. White House spokesperson John Kirby said more Americans are expected to exit Gaza on Monday as more aid enters the territory. Biden and Netanyahu also discussed the situation in the West Bank. Kirby said that from Reuters. John Kirby said this during a virtual audio-only news conference, and here's the follow-up questions.
You have said several times that this is the beginning of a conversation. It's now been 10 days since you publicly called for humanitarian pauses, and in that period of time, I think the pace of Israeli operations have increased, and many thousands of people have died. You said you believe that Israel needs to minimize collateral damage to the maximum extent possible. And I wanted to ask you, what if this is the beginning of the conversation, when do you think that conversation will progress? And do you think that Israel is minimizing collateral damage to the maximum extent possible.
We would like to see humanitarian pauses put in place as appropriate as soon as possible. And when I say we're at the beginning of the conversation, today's not the first time we've had that conversation with them, or this weekend's trip by Secretary Blinken's not the first conversation we've had with them. What I mean is this is an ongoing process. And we're going to continue to have that discussion with the Israelis for as long as it takes to see if we can't get to humanitarian pauses that can actually have a discrete difference on the battlefield. I'm sorry, you had a second question.
Oh, it was whether you believe, as you said, that your goal is that Israel will minimize collateral damage to the maximum extent possible. Do you believe that they're doing that?
It's like I said before. I mean, we have seen some indications that there are efforts being applied in certain scenarios to try to minimize it. But I don't want to overstate that. There have obviously been, to your point, many, many thousands of innocent people killed, and each one's a tragedy. And we don't want to see any innocent life taken as a result of this war. These people are victims too of this conflict, and we recognize that. And we're going to continue to work with our Israeli counterparts to do everything we can to urge them to be as discriminate as possible and as cautious and careful as possible as they prosecute these operations. They are up against a wily foe who is hiding behind civilians, tunneling beneath their homes, headquartering themselves in hospitals and schools, which makes any urban targeting is difficult. In a situation like this, where your enemy is deliberately trying to put people between you and them, it makes targeting enormously difficult. We know that from our own experiences in Iraq and Afghanistan, and we're just going to continue to try to share those perspectives as much as we can with our Israeli allies.
John Kirby is Strategic Communications Coordinator for the White House National Security Council in an virtual audio news conference today. Another article from Reuters, UN agency leaders saying enough is enough, demanded a humanitarian ceasefire on Monday, nearly a month into Gaza's war, as health authorities in the enclave said the death toll from Israeli strikes now exceeded 10,000. Washington Today continues in a moment.
Wyndham Hotels and Resorts makes travel possible for all. Whether it's the long haulers looking for a great cup of coffee, a roomier rest for the on a whim road trippers, or a place to make summer memories with the whole family. No matter who you are, where you're going, or why, with 24 trusted brands to choose from like La Quinta, Days Inn, and Super 8, your Wyndham is waiting. Get the lowest price at WyndhamHotels.com. Restrictions apply. Visit website for more details.
Welcome back to Washington Today, available as a podcast wherever you find your podcasts and on the C-SPAN Now mobile app. The Department of Veterans Affairs, writes Federal News Network, says major hiring efforts across the department allowed it to set all-time records for providing health care and benefits to veterans. The VA surged its hiring last year to stay ahead of demand under the PACT Act. The 2022 law expands health care and benefits for veterans exposed to toxic substances during their military service. VA leaders across the department told reporters on Friday the department will keep growing its workforce to keep pace with demand from an aging veteran population. That from Federal News Network. The VA Secretary Dennis McDonough spoke at the National Press Club today ahead of the Veterans Day holiday, November 11th, with an update on benefits provided, starting with the number of claims processed under the PACT Act.
Altogether, VA processed nearly 2 million claims in 2023, shattering the previous year's record to that point, the highest ever, by 16%. That meant 1.5 million vets and their families, and importantly, survivors, received over $163 billion in earned benefits. We're also providing more care to veterans. This year, VA delivered more than 116 million health care appointments, exceeding last year's number by more than 3 million appointments. And it's not just more care, it's better care, world-class care. Study after study shows we deliver better health outcomes than the rest of the healthcare system for our vets, which is a big reason why nearly 90% of vets who come to VA now trust us to deliver their outpatient care. 5.4 million people, including 4.1 million veterans, are taking their final rest in VA National Cemeteries. And we've doubled our online Veteran Legacy Memorial Program to nearly 10 million veterans, a digital platform, keeping veterans' stories alive long after they're gone. Now, behind all these statistics are veterans. Veterans like Commander Everett Alvarez and like Sergeant Major Kenneth Erickson. They're our neighbors, our friends. They're teachers, civic leaders, coaches, loved ones. They're continuing to serve America to defend and to strengthen our democracy long after they take off the uniform. And all our work at VA adds up to the single statistic that matters most. Veterans' lives improved, veterans' lives saved by the work that we do together.
The Veterans Affairs Department Secretary Dennis McDonough today at the National Press Club. Find his full event, runs an hour, at our video library at cspan.org. Today's Supreme Court oral argument, this one from Bloomberg Law, a majority of U.S. Supreme Court justices seem skeptical of the federal government's claim that it cannot be sued for failing to correct inaccurate information that appears on consumer credit reports. During oral argument on Monday, Justices Neil Gorsuch and Clarence Thomas joined the court's liberal wing in focusing on how Congress defined persons who are subject to the Fair Credit Reporting Act to include the government. The justices are being asked if Congress waived the government's sovereign immunity in FCRA enforcement provisions, which allowed violators to be held liable for damages in civil lawsuits. That reporting from Bloomberg Law. The case is Department of Agriculture, Rural Development, Rural Housing Service v. Kurtz. Here is Justice Elena Kagan questioning Benjamin Snyder, an assistant to the U.S. Solicitor General.
The definition has a lot of words, right? There's a person, there's a corporation, there's an association, there's an enterprise, et cetera, et cetera. You can see why Congress didn't want to say that every time Congress meant to refer to a lot of different entities. So, but, you know, statutory interpretation 101, that we take a defined term, we plug the definition in, and that's what the meaning of the statute is. So that's what the meaning of the statute is.
So, Justice Kagan, if the question here were just what the meaning of the words in the cause of action were, I would agree with you. So last term in Lac du Flambeau, for example, there was an express waiver of sovereign immunity that made absolutely clear that what Congress was intending to do was waive sovereign immunity, and it did so on behalf of governmental units and then defined governmental units elsewhere in the statute. And this sort of subbing in the words from the definition into the waiver of sovereign immunity would have worked perfectly there, because all you were asking was, what do the words that Congress used mean? But here, you're not asking just what do the words mean? You're asking about the necessary logical implication of what Congress has done.
Well, the necessary logical implication of what Congress has done is authorize a suit against people, persons, as defined in the definition section. Then you go to the definition section, and then you discover that what Congress has done is authorize a suit against natural persons, enterprises, and governments.
So respectfully, Justice Kagan, I don't think that's right. At the time that Congress adopted that definition, the one thing we know is that it wasn't doing so for purposes of allowing civil recovery against everyone covered by persons, because the statute didn't authorize recovery against persons.
Benjamin Snyder, Assistant U.S. Solicitor General, questioned by Supreme Court Justice Elena Kagan in today's oral argument in the case Agriculture Department, Rural Development, Rural Housing Service v. Kurtz. There is another Supreme Court case on Tuesday that C-SPAN will be covering live. It is U.S. v. Rahimi. dealing with whether people who have domestic violence protective orders against them can be in possession of a firearm. It's going to be live at 10 a.m. Eastern on Tuesday on C-SPAN Radio, C-SPAN 3 Television, streamed at cspan.org, and also on the C-SPAN Now mobile app. Tonight at 9 p.m. Eastern, C-SPAN continues our series in conjunction with the Library of Congress, Books That Shaped America, with a focus on Zora Neale Hurston's 1937 book, Their Eyes Were Watching God. It's set in Central and Southern Florida during the Jim Crow era, exploring life within the African-American community, race relations, gender roles, and female empowerment. The book is considered a classic of the Harlem Renaissance and has been highly influential on both African-American literature and women's literature. Our guest tonight will be Tiffany Ruby Patterson, who has taught classes at Vanderbilt University in Nashville about Hurston's work as an anthropologist and writer, and has written her own book titled Zora Neale Hurston and a History of Southern Life. One of the places we visited was the Zora Neale Hurston National Museum of Fine Arts in Eatonville, Florida, and spoke with its executive director, N.Y. Nathiri.
We're here at a special place that commemorates the importance of Zora Neale Hurston and the role that she has played and continues to play in identifying Eatonville as a literary destination. Now, this street, East Kennedy Boulevard, originally was a part of the road system called the Old Apopka Highway. So during the time of Zora Neale Hurston, she was born in 1891, died in 1960. Her parents brought her to Eatonville when she was basically a toddler. So in the early 1900s, this roadway, now called East Kennedy Boulevard, was actually the old Apopka Highway. It was the link between northeast Orange County, Maitland, and northwest Orange County, Apopka. And so the road itself is a historic roadway.
N.Y. Nathiri, executive director of the Zora Neale Hurston National Museum of Fine Arts in Eatonville, Florida. C-SPAN also spoke with Gary Richards, English professor at the University of Mary Washington, in a companion podcast.
Zora Neale Hurston was, without doubt, one of the most important writers of the 20th century United States literary scene. What I love about Hurston is she brought in a woman's voice. She brought in an African-American voice, and she would say, very importantly, she brought in a Southern voice to American literature, particularly in the 1920s, 30s, and 40s. So she was part of the Harlem Renaissance and was a unique voice within that grouping in American literature.
She was born in 1891 in Alabama. Tell us, Gary Richards, about her early years there, her family, and those early influences.
Sure. As you said, Hurston was born in Alabama. She was the granddaughter of enslaved people. She did not live, though, in Alabama long. Very early on, her father relocated to Central Florida, where there were opportunities there to be had in an all-black town. And after he scoped it out, this was Eatonville, Florida. It's in the Orlando area. The family relocated there. So Hurston had really, from her earliest memories, being part of a large family, but also within a town that was black run, black controlled. It was not without its tensions, but she throughout her life said that she had felt that that was very unique to grow up in kind of autonomous black enclave as far as civic life there in Eatonville, Florida.
Gary Richards is an English professor at the University of Mary Washington. You can find this companion podcast on Zora Neale Hurston wherever you find your podcast, and at cspan.org/podcast. And C-SPAN's Books That Shaped America, Hurston's Their Eyes Were Watching God, tonight at 9 p.m. Eastern on C-SPAN Radio, C-SPAN Television, cspan.org, and on the C-SPAN Now free video app. And thanks for listening to Washington Today. Sign up for C-SPAN's evening newsletter, Word for Word, also free, to get the stories making news in Washington sent to your inbox every day. Subscribe at cspan.org/connect. Have a good night.